Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Stoddard Kennedy. Chapter 15. Amesbury. Mother Webster, for so she was generally known, was a queer woman. She was a spiritualist of the type then called a drawing medium. She would produce strange drawings, which in turn she interpreted into messages from the departed. Captain Nathaniel Webster, her husband, was a retired sea captain, who held a good position in Manchester as superintendent of a cotton mill, and visited Amesbury only about twice a month, coming up on a Sunday just for the day. As a consequence, Mother Webster was left a good deal alone. And partly to relieve the loneliness of her life, and partly out of the generosity of her heart, opened her house to almost anyone in need, but especially to anyone interested in spiritualism, or what she would regard as kindred spirits. When Mary told her, as she seems to have done the first evening, that she was interested in something far in advance of spiritualism, that was more than enough for Mother Webster. A vivid picture of the woman herself and of her strange household is afforded in an account written for McClure's Magazine some 40 years later, by her granddaughter, a Mrs. Mary Ellis Bartlett. According to her, there was apparently no limit to Mother Webster's charity. Invalids, cripples, and other unfortunate persons, the account runs, were made welcome, and my grandmother took care of them when they were ill, and lodged and boarded them free of charge. In such circumstances, the guests could hardly refuse to take part in the spiritistic seances, which were evidently among Mother Webster's happiest relaxations. She had a room specially fitted up for the purpose in the rear of the front parlor. It was decorated in blue, as this was regarded as a color unusually pleasing to spirits. The room was furnished much as other rooms, with good sturdy New England tables and chairs. But Mother Webster always alluded to this equipment as spiritual furniture. Moreover, she had in the room a spiritual couch, upon which she took her daytime naps, and to which she even resorted occasionally at night if she was restless, being convinced that she could sleep there when she could not sleep anywhere else. To complete the furnishings, there was at the head of the table a large armchair which had belonged to Captain Webster's mother. It was alluded to as the spiritual chair, and Mother Webster always occupied this chair at her seances or when she was engaged on her spirit drawing. Above the spiritual room was a bedroom, a bright sunny room with a view over the river, and this room, much to her satisfaction as it must have been, Mother Webster turned over to her new guest. Mary was used to spiritualism and spiritualists. Later in life, she used to say that in those days, she found them more ready to listen to her than were most people, and in many cases, quick to abandon their views in favor of what she had to give them. And so, Mother Webster's spiritual room and its spiritual furniture had no terrors for Mary. She was far too grateful for Mrs. Webster's kindness, and it was not long before the two women became close friends. Mrs. Bartlett declares that Mrs. Patterson attended many of her grandmother's séances in the spiritual room, and it is more than likely that she did. Spiritistic séances in those days were like silver in the days of Solomon, nothing accounted of. It is, however, significant that as the winter wears on, Mary is found established in the spiritual room, using it as her study, seated in Mother Webster's spiritual chair, with the spiritual table strewn with her papers and books. The exact significance of this recorded fact may not be clear, but it seems reasonable to suppose that in securing the use of the spiritual room with its equipment for her study, Mary had at least persuaded Mother Webster that the room could thus be used without impairing in any way its spiritual value. Mother Webster, moreover, was much interested in Mary's writing. She seems to have grasped little of what it was about, but that it impressed her is shown by the fact that she dwelt in wonder to her granddaughter on how Mrs. Patterson, after she had written for hours, would gather up all the pages she had filled with writing and tear them up, because she could not make them read as she wished. Of the other guests in the house at the time Mary was there, there is no record, save in the case of two, a Mrs. Richardson and a young man destined later on to figure prominently in her story, named Richard Kennedy. Kennedy was a bright, energetic lad. He was no more. Who, left alone in the world, had, at the age of 18, established himself in a little box business which already employed several extra hands. From the first, he was tremendously interested in what Mrs. Patterson had to teach, and was eager to learn as much as he could about it. The same was probably true, in a measure, of many of the guests who came and went. Mrs. Bartlett does not mention it, but it seems likely that some of them were helped and even healed by Mary. For at the turn of the year, it began to be whispered about in the little town that in Mother Webster's house was a woman who worked miracles. Such stories would lose nothing in the telling. And by the time the spring came around, and Mary and Mother Webster would be going for a walk in the evening along the river bank, the curious would sometimes walk after them at a distance to see if, by any chance, Mrs. Patterson would walk on the water. Mary shrank from such notoriety, and was apparently beginning to wonder whether she ought not to move again, when the matter was suddenly settled for her in a way which must have made her feel that she had surely reached the depths of humiliation. It appears that almost from the first, when Captain Webster returned home on his bi-monthly visits, he had objected to Mary's presence. Whether he resented the assurance implied in her occupancy of the spiritual room and his wife's spiritual chair, or thought she had too much influence over her, in any case, according to Mrs. Bartlett, he insisted to his wife that Mrs. Patterson should not be allowed to remain. Mother Webster, however, she had a will of her own, indignantly refused, and no more would probably have been heard of the matter if it had not been for the arrival in the early summer of Mother Webster's son-in-law, William Ellis, from New York. William Ellis, to judge from his photograph, was a man of determination. Even in moments of relaxation, the photographer has discovered him seated at a desk clad in a flowered dressing gown and shod with embroidered slippers. His straight mouth, flanked by side whiskers, is firm and set of purpose. His wife had died a few years previously, leaving him with three young children, and it had been his custom to have the children spend the summer in Amesbury with their grandparents. It was a satisfactory arrangement for him in every way, but he strongly objected to Mother Webster's penchant for hospitality, and trading, no doubt, on her desire to have her grandchildren with her through the summer, he insisted on the departure of all his mother-in-law's guests, or such of them, at any rate, as he did not approve of, before the children arrived. His daughter, Mrs. Bartlett, one of the children, has left a vigorous picture of her father's method of procedure. "When it was time for us to leave New York," she writes, "my father always went to Amesbury in advance of the rest of us, in order to clear my grandmother's house of broken-down spiritualists and sick persons, so that we might have enough room in the house, and because he thought the atmosphere of so much sickness and spiritualism was unwholesome for young children." On Saturday evening, early in June 1868, William Ellis arrived in Amesbury on his annual visitation. Mrs. Bartlett does not mention his attitude towards any of the other guests, but in regard to Mary Patterson, he was decisive from the first moment. She would have to go, and at once. Mother Webster emphatically refused, and at first seems to have stood her ground. But faced with the usual alternative, and also, it would seem, with the possibility of violence, at last, tearfully, consented to ask Mrs. Patterson to go. It was just the kind of tyranny to arouse in Mary an indignation and determination to resist which had the whole Baker tradition behind it. She took one look at Mother Webster's tear-stained face, and another at Mother Webster's son-in-law, and then quietly but firmly refused to move. She had, however, to deal with something cruder and more brutal than had ever previously come into her experience. The day had been hot and sultry, and towards evening a storm had broken, one of those semi-tropical thunderstorms which sweep occasionally over New England at night in high summer, with rain pouring down at times in unbelievable deluge, and the sullen roar of one crash of thunder rolling in on the echo of the last, each flash of lightning the while only rendering more impenetrable the following darkness. Storm or no storm, Mr. Ellis was determined. Mrs. Patterson should go. The rest of the story is perhaps best told in Mrs. Bartlett's own words. My father, she says, commanded Mrs. Patterson to leave. And when she steadfastly refused to go, he had her trunk dragged from her room and set it outside the door, insisted on her also going out the door. And when she was outside, he closed the door and locked it. It was dark at the time, and a heavy rain was falling. Very fortunately, the front door of the house was protected by a small entrance porch. And there, on the narrow stoop, Mary sat down and waited, not knowing what to do or where to go. It is easy, and perhaps not altogether idle, to speculate as to the thoughts that passed through her mind as she sat there listening to the echoing peals of thunder and the swirl of the rain as it swept by. One thought almost surely would have been there, the recollections of Abigail's offer. We will build a house for you next to our own and settle an income upon you. We can be together very much, and you can pursue your writing. There is only one thing I ask of you, Mary. Mary knew Abigail well enough to know that the offer was still open. The harder the battle, the more frequent the apparent defeats, the more would Abigail love to win in the end. But the one thing that Abigail asked was the one thing that Mary would never give. And so, if the thought ever came at all, it only came to be dismissed. How long she waited there is not known. But after a time, she heard the door being unlocked, and next moment, she saw Richard Kennedy and Mrs. Richardson standing in the doorway. As the door was shut and locked behind them, Mrs. Richardson told Mary that she and Dick had decided that if she, Mary, was to be turned out, they would go too. That she knew a kindly woman living nearby, one Sarah Bagley, who would certainly take them in for the night, and possibly they could make arrangements to stay there permanently. Dick would carry their baggage over, and they might as well go at once. After waiting, no doubt, for a lull in the storm, Mary and her friends set out, and a few minutes later were drying themselves around the hospitable fire of Sarah Bagley's kitchen, telling their story and finding a full measure of that kindness and compassion which Mrs. Richardson had anticipated. One door had closed, but another had opened. Next day, Mrs. Richardson and Richard Kennedy seemed to have gone elsewhere, but Mary arranged to stay. Sarah Bagley had evidently heard all about her, if she did not know her personally, and the agreement reached between them was that in addition to a small sum which Mary would pay for board, she should teach Miss Bagley what she could of the doctrine she was evolving. In Miss Bagley, Mary found a woman much more in her own tradition than any she had associated with at all intimately for some time. A spinster living alone, She was the last survivor of a well-known New England family. Her father, Squire Bagley, was a man of much the same type as Squire Baker or Squire Pierce. His journal, which is one of the literary landmarks of New England, is a delightful haphazard mosaic of great names, shrewd comment, humorous aphorisms, and household expenses. The Bagleys had once been very well off, but the Civil War and changing times had reduced the family fortune, until Sarah, the sole survivor, was left with the old house on Merrimack Street and little besides. She supplemented that little by working as a dressmaker and managed somehow. Old Squire Bagley had been a Universalist, and so was Sarah. But of late years, she, like many others, had turned to spiritualism. She had an open mind, however, and from the first displayed an eagerness to understand the new teaching, which, to the much enduring Mary Patterson, must have been strangely refreshing. Richard Kennedy had secured a room close by and would come in and join them in the evenings. He, too, was eager to learn. And gradually, as the days and weeks passed, a great change came over Sarah Bagley. She had been a very lonely, stalemated woman. She kept her head up in proper New England style, changed her gown, and tidied up for company every afternoon, and sat in the front parlor on Sundays. But the glory of it all had departed, and the coming of Mary Patterson into her life seems to have brought some of it back again. Georgine Milmine, when collecting material for her articles in McClure's magazine, interviewed a number of people who had known Mary in those days. Some of them had come to be strongly opposed to her and her teaching. But one and all, they loved to talk of her and were glad to have known her. As Miss Milmine sums it up, there was something about her, according to these people, that continually excited and stimulated. And she gave people the feeling that a great deal was happening. In a household like that of Sarah Bagley's, where nothing ever happened, this must indeed have been as a wind from the south. To Mary, it would all have an unaccustomed sweetness, for the small circle in which Sarah moved was very different to the strange medley which surrounded Mother Webster. Whittier was one of her closest friends. When Squire Bagley died, leaving Sarah and her sister little beyond the old family house, Whittier was one of the first to come to the rescue. And when Sarah, in order to eke out their income, sought to teach school, Whittier did all he could to help her and was one of her committee men. Then it was of Captain Valentine Bagley, Sarah's uncle, that Whittier wrote his poem, The Captain's Well, which tells of how the captain, being wrecked on the coast of Arabia and almost dying of thirst, vowed a vow that if ever he got back to Amesbury, he would dig a well by the wayside so that the wayfaring man and the wayfaring beast that passed by might always have the means to slake their thirst. The captain did return to Amesbury and digged his well by the wayside near to where Sarah lived. And so the Bagley home was a home of gracious tradition, and the little town itself a place of peace and quiet. The belfry and steeple on Meeting House Hill, the brook with its dam and the gray grist mill. Mary always retained a deep affection for Amesbury. It is not certain that she met Whittier at this time, but she did meet him later on a return visit, and in circumstances which both must long have remembered. Meanwhile, happy as conditions were, and busy as she was writing and teaching, Mary was ever ready to make a move which promised wider opportunity and greater independence. After she had been with Miss Bagley about 6 months, such an opportunity presented itself in the form of an invitation from a friend in Stoughton, a Mrs. Sally Wentworth, to visit her. Mary had met Mrs. Wentworth when she was living with the Crafts at Stoughton. Mrs. Wentworth had brought her daughter Lucy, who was suffering from tuberculosis, to Hiram Crafts to see if he could help her. And as the child quite definitely improved under his care, her mother became very interested in what Mrs. Patterson was teaching, and eagerly desired to learn more of it. She was herself a practical nurse, with strong leanings towards spiritualism, and her story affords an interesting view of the quasi-magical healing methods which were so common in New England in the years immediately following the Civil War. Mrs. Wentworth was herself a gifted rubber, and combining forces, as she did at times, with old Asa Holbrook, a spiritualist and clairvoyant doctor, who appears to have had a considerable reputation and following, she undoubtedly thought that a knowledge of Mrs. Patterson's method would still further enhance her own and old Asa Holbrook's powers. And so Mary came back to Stoughton. Her arrangement with Mrs. Wentworth, as it was finally worked out, was that Mrs. Wentworth was to pay $300 for a complete course of instruction, but that this payment was to be received not in cash, but in board and lodging over a considerable time. At first, the arrangement seems to have worked out very well for all concerned. The daughter, Lucy, now apparently fully restored to health, became devoted to Mary, as did her older brother, Charles. They were 15 and 17, respectively. And many years afterwards, in an interview with Sybil Wilbur, Lucy Wentworth described how eagerly the two looked forward each day to the time when Mary would have finished her writing for the day and would unlock her door. She evidently had to keep it locked against them, and let them in. "I loved her," Lucy Wentworth declared in this interview, "because she made me love her. She was beautiful and had a good influence over me. I used to be with her every minute that she was not writing or otherwise engaged. And then she went on to tell how they would read and talk together, and perhaps most interesting of all, take long walks in the country. Whatever it was that Mary was writing and thinking at that time, she was evidently steadily working out the problem of her own health. She was, moreover, working out, or perhaps it would be more true to say, beginning to be aware of another problem which was to present itself to her in many different forms repeatedly in the future. The problem of family relations in connection with what she was trying to do. It was, of course, the age-old problem of Martha and Mary. In every family with which she was brought in intimate contact, this problem inevitably presented itself. The Russells at Lynn, the Crafts at Taunton, the Websters at Amesbury, her own people at Sandbutton. And now the same thing was apparently to happen with the Wentworths. Mary, however, this time, seems to have been dimly aware of what was coming and to have done her best to prevent it. The devotion of Lucy Wentworth was clearly the kind to arouse something very like resentment with other members of the family. She would not tolerate the smallest criticism of Mrs. Patterson, and when her eldest brother, Horatio, who was married and lived close by, or her cousin Kate Clapp, much given to mimicry, would, as they often did, speak jokingly of something they had heard of Mrs. Patterson's teaching, or their mother's interpretation of it, Lucy would spring to the defense in such a way as to ensure a renewal of the attack on still more generous lines. It was probably for this reason, more than any other, that Mary tried to restrain Lucy Wentworth's devotion. That she was, in a large measure, successful is shown by the fact that she remained with the Wentworths the better part of a year before the inevitable break took place. The exact cause of the break is not quite clear. Mary's life at this point is rapidly moving into that atmosphere of bitter controversy and clashing opinion which was to surround her in ever-widening range right through to the end. Thenceforward, apparently, there could be no such thing as neutrality and very little moderation in the average estimate of men and women regarding her. On the one side in this simple matter of record is Horatio Wentworth's lurid story of how Mrs. Patterson was finally retired to her room, which was over Mr. Wentworth's, and having locked herself in, deliberately hammered on the floor, keeping it up with short intermissions for a long time, in order to prevent the sick man from sleeping. Then, as if this were not enough, he adds that when they finally did get her out of the house, they found on entering her room the carpets slashed up through the middle, the feather bed all cut to pieces, and an obvious attempt to set the house on fire. Side by side with this shameful and shameless picture may be placed that provided in Lucy Wentworth's account of the matter. It lacks the vigor and resource of Horatio's narrative. But what it lacks in vigor, it would seem to gain in probability. A coolness, she says, grew up in the family toward our guest. I don't know how it came about. My father thought she absorbed my mother too much, and that she was weaning me away from them. I never missed anyone as I missed her. And so, Mary packed up her few things once more and moved on. But her years of wandering and obscurity were almost over. She had used to the uttermost the days of small things. She had preached her gospel to anyone who would listen. She had taught now a shoemaker, now a seamstress, now a boy in a box factory, and everywhere she had gone, she had been writing. The pile of papers tied up with a string had grown bulkier and bulkier, and the more it grew, so much the more a great deal did she treasure it. As the sharp-tongued Catherine Clapp has left record, she called it her Bible. As a matter of fact, the manuscript, which she was now working on, and it is still preserved, was the beginning of a monumental work to be called The Bible and Its Spiritual Meaning. For the Bible-minded Mary Baker must now reconcile what she saw, or thought she saw, in Quimbyism with what she had always accepted as eternally sacred.